This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
To be honest with you, what gets me the most excited is that we don't need any new technology. We can get to where we need to go with the technology that we have right now.
Last week on Sea Change Radio, I spoke with Adam Browning, the executive director of Vote Solar, a nonprofit organization that advocates for solar power adoption. This week, the second part of my discussion with Browning. We discussed the lessons we can learn from success stories like the German solar industry, as well as high-profile flops like Solyndra. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives to hear from Matt Wasson, whose nonprofit Appalachian Voices works to reduce the impact of coal on the Appalachian region. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Adam Browning. He's the co-founder and executive director of Vote Solar. It's a nonprofit solar advocacy organization working to bring solar to the mainstream. Adam, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, happy to be here. Thank you.
Adam, you're an advocate for expanding solar here in the U.S. In Germany, residential installed solar prices are currently much cheaper. I've read as much as one half. What do you attribute that largely to?
Yeah, so Germany has, you know, instituted a program with their feed-in tariffs where, homeowners, business owners install solar panels on their rooftop and they sell it back to the utility. They don't use it. In California, most of the solar that goes on rooftops, you use yourself behind the meter. So you're not selling it to the utility. You're generating for your own usage. So you're offsetting your retail purchases from the utility instead of selling wholesale power to the utility at a wholesale rate. This is kind of a wonky discussion. It gets a little bit in the weeds. I would just, you know, I'm pointing out that when you talk about Germany's solar costs being half, that's just for the residential installations. And it's important, and it's an important distinction, but it's also, it does provide really important lessons for how we can continue to reduce the cost of rooftop solar here in the U.S. So Lawrence Berkeley National Labs has issued a really excellent analysis that looks at the differences between the installed costs for residential solar in the United States and the installed costs for residential solar in Germany. And they find a huge delta. It is approximately, as you say, half the cost in Germany for just the residential solar installations. They go further. They pull out, okay, why is that? Where are the differences? So a good chunk of it is actually in Germany, local municipal, you know, permitting agencies don't require you to get a permit to install a solar system. You just do it. So that actually, you know, here in the U.S., we have places where to do a residential solar installation, you know, it's the same permitting agency that you have to talk to if you want to build an addition onto your house. They'll charge you up to $500 to $1,000 just to get that permit. You know, you may have to go make, you know, three or four trips, send a truck in to get that permit. You don't know exactly what kind of requirements that they have because they haven't made clear exactly. Do you need, what kind of engineering drawings do you need from it? Local jurisdictions can do a lot to reduce the cost of doing business and make your local installed costs of solar much more cheaply. The other big deal in Germany, when you compare it to the installed costs in the U.S., is really the cost of customer acquisition. So SolarCity is a residential and commercial solar installer that just went public, just had their IPO. They revealed that for them, for every customer that they sign up, it costs them a couple thousand dollars to get that customer. We just don't have the same sort of market penetration in the U.S., the same sort of awareness that Germany has been able to build by having all that density as well as the richness of their feed-in tariff. That cost of customer acquisition continues to go down. We've seen some really interesting programs that we're getting involved in as well, where you essentially do group solar purchases. So in Massachusetts, for example, the Massachusetts Energy Office has established these solarized programs where they did this with 8 different towns. They got municipal leaders to say, let's do a Groupon for solar energy. And they do a lot of local advertising, and they set it up. The more people that get involved, the lower the price goes. And they bid out those jobs to local installers. And the results have been absolutely extraordinary. They've achieved installed costs, I would say 40% discount to average installed costs in the U.S. And it's really just all about scale. It's all about the more people that come together, the lower the prices end up being. And so that's what we're trying to achieve. I think that this is a virtuous cycle where the larger the scale that we get, the lower the prices. And that, that's a lot of what we've learned from the German example.
I think you and Lawrence Livermore are forgetting one very key variable, though, that Fox News referenced last month, which was that Germany gets more sun. That's what they attributed this to. So.
Exactly. So I can't.
Did you see that?
I did see that, and it was flabbergasting. So, the past year we've seen, I would say, something different that we hadn't seen before, which is this, from certain sectors, a dedicated demonization of renewable energy. And I think a lot of it was driven by election year politics. So this is, where how Solyndra, for example, became a household name, even though, we could name any number of companies, fossil fuel companies that have, gone out of business that dwarf in scale what happened with Solyndra.
And probably got a lot of federal aid as well.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I don't want to minimize the importance here. What happened with Solyndra was a tragedy. When it comes to the nuke industry, it's a way of doing business. I mean, there are ratepayers in Florida that are paying $11 a month for nuke plants that haven't been completed and will never be built.
The average, it's usually 20 to 30 years to build these things traditionally in the U.S. anyway, right?
And they will never exist without U.S. same type of loan guarantees that went to Solyndra. And there have been, economic failures that dwarf what happened there. So not to say that that wasn't a bad thing, but just to put it into perspective. So, I've been on Fox News. I've talked with some of these news anchors, and really do, the things they say are outright lies. And so I was actually in a perverse way thrilled when they came out with this latest tidbit, because it just showed in a way that you don't actually have to, spend your life working on energy policy to realize that they're just full of it.
There was no wonkishness behind it at all.
There was no, you don't need to be a wonk in order to realize at that point that they're just making it up. They just lie.
I feel like this is the beginning. Oh, I've loved you for a million years. And if I thought our love was ending, I'd find myself drowning in my own tears. Oh, 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 oh. You brought the sunshine.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the executive director of Vote Solar, Adam Browning. Let's dive back into the wonkery for a second. Is there any discrepancy between Germany and the U.S. because of the way their home ownership is structured? I don't know what the percentage of rental units they have in Germany, but I know here we have almost a third or around a third of U.S. homes are rental units, and there's been very little aggressive policy to try to address that one third of American homes to try to get solar into them, as well as from the private sector. They've kind of given up on that. They say, well, that's just a stone that we'll have to turn once we get the two thirds of American homeowners. Is there any kind of relationship between how the German success story has been?
So yeah, again, you know, the German model has been not in the past. It hasn't been for generation for your you know, you install a solar system for your own usage. It's been all about selling it to the utility under guaranteed contracts, which have started out at something like 67 cents per kilowatt hour back in 2004, which is really high. You know, when, you know, they're essentially buying solar power for 67 and then selling it for 21 cents. It was their way of stimulating the industry, and it worked perfectly. Those guaranteed contracts have come down. And so we've gotten to the point where they're now basically on par with retail generation, and it's changing in Germany, where you're now seeing new policies that don't rely on these feed-in tariff contracts. It's about self-consumption. It's about generation for your own usage. But under those guaranteed contracts, you're absolutely right. You don't actually have to own your own house in order for you to have an economic investment. You can sell it to the utility, whether you're a renter or you're not a renter. We've had to be more creative in the United States in order to solve this problem. The bigger question here is, like, how can we expand access to the solar economy? How can we get more people to participate and enjoy the benefits of participating in the solar economy? So we are working here in California and in a couple of other states on shared solar programs where renters, anyone that doesn't own their own roof or is in a shady place, can buy a portion of an offsite solar system and have that credit come to their bill, come directly to them. So it's not necessarily on their own roof, but they're making an investment in a solar system that's sited in a good place for solar collection, and they receive the benefit of it. So,
is this almost like a personal carbon offset program?
Sure, but much more actually visceral and tangible. You're not just buying a credit, you're actually buying a piece of that solar system.
Your energy is getting delivered by the sun. It's not, you're not just paying off like a company would just donate to good causes, but they're still getting dirty energy into their to light their lights.
Exactly. So, you know, you're again directly involved. There's also, you know, a lot of other interesting things that are happening right now. There's a company in Oakland called Mosaic, with the idea of really crowdsourcing solar energy projects. So it allows you to make an investment in somebody else's solar system and receive a rate of return on that investment. If you think about, solar panels are solid state electronics. There's no moving parts. They come with manufacturer's guarantees for 20, 25 years. They're really pretty safe investments. And you should be able to invest in these generating resources and earn a rate of return on par with you know, a bond style rate of return. So what they've done is they've, working with the SEC and the IRS, have established a project by which ordinary investors in California and in New York, they're working on other states, can in the end just, you know, invest in these solar projects and earn something, I think it's about 4.5%, which is better than any bond investment or money market that you'll see right now. So these are ways of bringing new capital into the system and allowing people to be able to participate in the solar economy that couldn't do it before, which I think is really key to building the political base for this transition to renewable energy. This is what we're really talking about in many ways, is moving away from a really centralized, monopolistic style of generating and consuming energy to a much more decentralized and democratic way of participating in the decisions that impact us when it comes to whether you invest in fossil fuels or you invest in renewable energy resources. This is one of the reasons why I love solar.
Adam, we've been focusing on the financing of solar, but can you talk about some of the breakthrough technologies that have you excited? I've been reading about solar shingles, which just look like they're technically just rooftop items in some ways that also produce energy. And there's been some breakthrough in quantum dot technology, solar technology. So what gets you excited about where things are headed on a technology side, on the technology
side? Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. And to be honest with you, what gets me the most excited is that we don't need any new technology. We can get to where we need to go with the technology that we have right now. Increased investment in research and development is always a good thing, but let's not let that be the thing that says, let's wait to do renewables. The plain vanilla stuff that we have right now is sufficient. It generates the same kind of electricity that some magic new solar panel that may or may not happen in the future will generate. There you're just talking about something that would potentially be more energy dense. The technology that we have right now can get us to where we need to go in terms of being effective against climate change. That said, you're right. There are fun new things that are happening.
But they're really just affecting the marginal cost and the aesthetics.
It's the aesthetics. It's the market. Who are the market players? So let's take, for example, the Dow Chemical Company has a new, totally cool product called the Powerhouse. It's the Dow Powerhouse Solar Shingle. And it's a flexible photovoltaic product that rolls out, looks exactly or almost exactly like your asphalt shingles. And it's installed the same way that you would install your asphalt shingle product. It replaces what otherwise would be ordinary building materials. And it's not that much harder, if at all, to install that product than, again, your normal asphalt shingle. So what does that mean? Well, anyone that didn't want to install solar because of the aesthetics doesn't have that excuse anymore. That's probably not a huge game-changing market. What it does do is that anyone that's getting a new roof, now those roofers have a new product that they can sell. They can say, oh, did hail destroy your roof? Well, we can put in a new roof for you. Would you like a regular roof that will cost you $20,000? Or would you like a roof that will pay you, that will generate your own electricity every day for the next 25, 30 years? Which roof would you rather have? It makes it much easier for that kind of transition, that kind of sale. It gives roofers, which is a huge industry in this country, an easy way to sell a much better product. So, that's one of the reasons why I'm really excited about, say, like the Dow Powerhouse Shingle, is that not that it's fundamentally it doesn't generate a different type of electricity. It's not more powerful than anything else, but it solves other problems and it brings new participants into the solar market. And I think really that's what we're looking at. We're looking at new ways of going solar, but we don't need to wait for those. Those things will happen and they'll be cool, but it's not that there's this magic new breakthrough technology that is either going to happen or that we need to wait for it to happen in order for us to have a solution to climate change.
The co-founder and executive director of Vote Solar. People can go to votesolar.org to learn more about it. Adam Browning. Adam, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. I was really glad to be here.
Little darling, it's been a long, long, lonely winter. Little darling,
seems like this. Little district here. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right. Little darling, the smiles are returning to the faces.
If you ever find yourself wanting to know more about the music we play here on Sea Change Radio, go to seachangeradio.com and click on the Music tab at the top of the page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Matt Wasson. He's the Director of Programs for Appalachian Voices. Matt, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks a bunch, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
Somebody who doesn't live in the shadows of a mountain, why is mountaintop removal mining important for them?
Well, one of the big things that I think a lot of people don't understand is that they are directly connected to it because they are essentially paying for it on their electricity bills. And you know, we actually created a tool on ilovemountains.org that a lot of people have used that shows you directly. You can actually go right there on the front page, type in your zip code and see the power plants that are producing the electricity that's powering your home and the specific mountaintop removal mines that are supplying that power plant with coal. And you know that I think when somebody does that, it really conveys that this isn't just something that's happening to someone else. This is something that you are deeply connected with every time you turn on your lights. And obviously it's also something that you can do something about.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Matt Wasson. He's a PhD in ecology and the Director of Programs for Appalachian Voices. If mountaintop removal mining is becoming more and more popular in West Virginia, is this also the case in Wyoming, Matt? Or is there something different at play with the removal of coal in the Big Sky region of the country?
Well, so it's certainly the mining out west has its own impacts that are it's not mountaintop removal. It's other types of mining. It has other impacts, and I'm not going to try to say one is that what's happening out there is okay. It's certainly not mountaintop removal, and what's happening in Appalachia, one of the big differences is happening right above people's homes, right where people live, and I think that's one of the reasons why it has such a dramatic human impact compared to some other types of mining. But from the industry side of things, it's all the same. I mean, they're chasing the biggest profit margin, right? And some of the companies, it's a lot cheaper to mine coal in Wyoming and Montana than it is to mine coal in Appalachia. Part of that has to do with the fact that there's just really big coal seams out there. Part of it has to do with the fact that we've been mining coal for 100 years in Appalachia, and a lot of the highest quality and easiest to access coal seams have already been mined out. So both of those things are at play, but they're just chasing profits, and the same is true with mountaintop removal. They don't save a lot of money on production costs doing mountaintop removal versus doing some types of underground mining techniques, but they reduce production costs a little bit, and that helps them to compete against Wyoming or Illinois for market share from coal-fired power plants. And so that's and it helps them outcompete each other. So it's not that you have to do mountaintop removal in order to mine coal. It's that companies are doing it because it gives them a little bit of an edge on their competitors. The way that they get that edge is by dramatically cutting down on the labor costs by just not having to hire nearly as many miners for every ton of coal they produce.
Well, who are we supposed to believe when it comes to regulation of the coal industry? I've read studies that say the electric utility industry claims that regulating the disposal of coal ash could eliminate up to 316,000 jobs. While there's, on the flip side, I've read that coal ash regulation would create 28,000 jobs. That's quite a head scratcher. And I guess my question is, is coal ash regulation an important first step, or do you think that's just putting a Band-Aid on a much deeper wound? Or or is coal ash regulation a positive way to try to not only create jobs, but to clean up this industry?
Well, in terms of who to believe on these job studies, you know, my recommendation is just tune them out. It doesn't, none of them are really get to the point. There will be jobs if we produce electricity from coal. There will be jobs if we produce electricity from renewables. And, you know, you can argue about, you know, which one might create more jobs on the margins. But in reality, that's not the important thing. The important thing is that it is absolutely unacceptable to blow up our mountains and poison people in order to produce electricity a little more cheaply. And even that is arguable whether it's more cheaply, but very powerful vested interests like these coal companies like to frame their arguments in terms of jobs, but they don't care about jobs. I mean, they invented mountaintop removal mining. The whole point of mountaintop removal mining is to eliminate jobs. It's to, you know, instead of employing lots of miners to dig into a mountain and get coal out of it, it's about employing, you know, taking the miner out of the mining equation. It's about, you know, replacing miners with explosives and giant equipment and you know, so that they can cut down on labor costs. And so anytime you hear these industries talking about jobs, that's just talking points. That's not what they care about. There is no reason you should even listen to them or care about what they have to say about jobs. They're not, it's just politics that they're playing.
So it seems like our political class often is just arguing over who loves coal more. For those of us who get frustrated with this situation, how can they tap into some of the groups that you're associated with, like Appalachian Voices and ILoveMountains.org? How can they tap into your organizations and others to try to turn that frustration into positive advocacy?
Well, and the first thing is, you know, I tell people this, I have my own resistance. I get too many emails. So many people get too many emails and they're really reluctant to, you know, sign up on a list. But, you know, what I tell people is, look, if you care about this, if you're the only way that you can do something about this is to stay engaged, to stay informed as to what's, you know, what's happening in Congress or what rules are being made by the EPA right now. And the only way to do that is to, you know, for people who are concerned about mountaintop removal coal mining, who want to see this travesty end, we have a little sign-up thing on ILoveMountains.org. And if people sign up, then every 2-3 weeks, they're going to get an email saying, you know, what's happening in Congress, what's happening at the White House, what, you know, and help them communicate what they care about, you know, pretty efficiently so that they don't have to give up their lives or their fun time to you know, go to war on this, but that they can be part of a larger movement. And if we all kind of put our shoulder to the wheel, then we can have as much power as the coal industry. But it just takes people, you know, the first thing you got to do, there's a lot of things I could say that people could do, but the first thing you got to do is, you know, on mountaintop removal, go to ILoveMountains.org, sign up on the list. It's okay, we're not going to sell your name. You just have to be engaged at that level. That's step one.
Matt Wasson, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Fela Kuti, Stevie Wonder, and Richie Havens. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.